Love, Lecture Number 6, 26th of December, 1976, at the Bhagwan Shirasni Ashram, Pune.
The first question. The Istinary School of Anthroposophy teaches one to have a strong will. This is a departure from traditional Eastern thought. What is this will? How does this will relate to the ego? The East and the West up to now have worked as polar opposites. The West through the will, the East through surrender. The West through the ego, the East through absolute egolessness. The way of the West is that of the male, and the way of the East is that of the female. East believes in passivity. God comes to you when you are absolutely passive, receptive, a nothing, just a awaiting, a prayerful awaiting, with no effort at all on your part. The way of the West is aggressive. The way of the male. Man has to seek. Man has to go. Man has to conquer. Even God has to be conquered. Nature has to be conquered. Truth has to be conquered. Both have failed because both are partial. They had to fail. East has failed tremendously as West has failed. Because man is not only male and man is not only female, man is both and more. Man is both the yin and yang, and a greater religion, a far more synthetical religion is needed, in which East and West will lose their old conflict. Istinar is the representative of the Western mind. He revolted against theosophy and created a new school, anthroposophy. Theosophy was Eastern. Blavatsky, Annie Besant, Leadbeater and Alcott, they had surged into the East, into the old scriptures, traditions, old masters, and they have come to a certain conclusion about the East, that if you surrender, God happens. Theosophy means, theo means God, sophy means love. You simply love like a woman. You wait. You remain in a welcoming mood. Only that welcome mood is needed, and God penetrates you. You become the feminine and he becomes the male. That is the allegory of Krishna and his girlfriends. Krishna is God, the male. And the seeker, the devotee, is a female, a girlfriend, a gopi. One has to become feminine to reach to God. That has been the essential core of Eastern thought, religion, philosophy. Istinar revolted against it. First he was a theosophist. But by and by he became aware that this is not possible for him to accept. He created, against theosophy, a new movement, a new school. He called it anthroposophy. Anthropo means man. Theo means God. Love of God is theosophy. Love of man is anthroposophy. He placed man into the very center. God is not in the center of his thinking. Man is at the center. For theosophy, God is at the center, the Krishna, playing on his flute, and man is dancing the dance around him. The girlfriends, the gopis. Man is on the periphery. God is at the center. He turned the whole thing upside down. He puts man in the center. Man becomes the central thing. In the West, man has remained the central thing. In the East, man is peripheral. Now, both the efforts have failed because both are partial. Man is both man and female together. It has to be so. You are born of a mother and a father. How you can be just man or just woman? Within your soul, your mother continues to live and your father too. And you have to be a deep harmony of the two. I call that man religious who has come to a great harmony within his own self, the harmony between his mother and father. They are still quarreling within you. They are still fighting. It is not only that when you were a child, your mother and father were fighting. They are still fighting in each of yourselves. So there are two possibilities. A man who is still in conflict and has not come to a deep understanding of his polarities. Then he has to choose. Either he becomes an egoist if he chooses the man, the young. If he chooses the woman, then he becomes surrendered. If he chooses in the woman. But in both the cases, one part will suffer. The unchosen part will suffer. And you will never be whole. And how you can be holy if you are not whole? The part that is neglected, rejected, will take its revenge. The part that you have rejected will become your unconscious. Unconscious is nothing but the rejected part of your being. There is a possibility of a humanity in future when unconscious will not exist. If we stop rejecting, unconscious will disappear. Man can become absolutely conscious, only conscious. And that's what we mean by Buddha, the awakened soul. It means now there is no rejected part. You have absorbed your totality. You have accepted all your facets. You have become multidimensional. Now the polarity is no more in contradiction. It has become complementary. Your woman inside helps your man. Your man inside helps the woman. They have fallen in love with each other. Conflict has disappeared. They have become one. They are wed together. This is the spiritual marriage. And only out of this marriage you will be born. Only out of this inner meeting of the contradictions you will be born. This is the whole philosophy, the concept of Trinity. The concept of Trinity is beautiful and has many meanings. God the Father, the Holy Ghost and the Son. Of course, the Holy Ghost is not a right name. People who coined that must have been male chauvinists. Otherwise, Holy Ghost is not right. The Mother, the Father, the Mother and the Son. Then it is perfectly true, factual. The father and the mother are in you. The son is still missing. Your father and mother have not met inside you. They have met outside you, so your body is created. When they meet inside you, your soul will be created, the son will be born, and that is the birth of Christ. The East has suffered because the East became feminine. That's why anybody could conquer it. It lost willpower. It lost zest, enthusiasm to live. It lost energy. It became very fatalistic. It became very relaxed. The whole history of the East is the history of being conquered by others. History of poverty. History of no science, no technology. It is not a beautiful history. Yes, few beautiful people happen: Buddha, Mahavir, Krishna, Kabir, Nanak, Dadu. Few beautiful people. But they are exceptionals. They cannot be counted. The greater mass, the greater humanity has lived in a very ugly way, miserable way, in deep anguish. At this cost, if one Buddha happens and one Kabir and one Nanak, it is not worth. The cost is too much. The West has suffered from the male orientation. Conflict, struggle, violence, fight, and no rest, no possibility of any relaxation. Great tension in the mind, hankering for speed, ambition, competition. A cutthroat competition, each fighting with everybody else. Very hostile atmosphere. Of course, it has created mad people, it has created neurotic people. Still, few beautiful people have existed on the fringe. A Christ, a Saint Teresa, Saint Francis, an Eckhart. But this cannot be said to be a success. The philosophy has failed. East and West both have failed. That's my whole effort here. What I am trying to do is to bring East and West closer. The twain can meet. Kipling is wrong when he says East is East and West is West, and the twain shall never meet. I say they can meet. They have to meet. Now everything will depend, even the possibility of a future humanity will depend on that meeting. Kipling has to be proved wrong. They have not met up to now, that's true. Kipling is right about the past, but wrong about the future. Has to be wrong, otherwise humanity cannot exist. Both are suffering. The East from outward poverty, the West from inner poverty. Both have tremendously failed. Grand failures, but failures. A man has to be a synthesis of will and surrender. A man has to grow his willpower, his ego, first. My approach is that if life is going to be for 70 years average, then 35 years, the beginning of life, should be devoted to strengthen the ego and willpower. And one should listen to Nietzsche, and one should listen to Skinner, and one should listen to Freud, and the ego has to be strengthened, made very integrated. And after the year 35, one has to learn relaxing and dropping the ego and becoming more and more surrendered to the divine. West, the first part of life, is the second part of life. Life should start as Western and should end as Eastern. One should first go into the world. Into the world will be needed. One should go and fight and struggle, because struggle gives you sharpness, intelligence. But one should not continue fighting and fighting to the very end. Then what is the point? Fight, sharpen your intelligence, know the ways of the world, wander all over the world, be a conqueror, and then move inwards. Now you have known the outside, try to know the inner. And to know the inner, one has to relax. One has to forget anxiety, anguish, tension. One has to be non-competitive. Will is not needed. To conquer the world, will is needed. To conquer God, will is not needed. To conquer God means to be conquered by God. To conquer God means to relax and surrender into His feet. Now this will seem very difficult, very illogical. I am an illogical person. My understanding is this, that only strong egos can surrender. Weak egos cannot surrender. I come every day across weak egos. Whenever a weak ego comes, he hesitates. Surrender or not to surrender. To take sannyas or not to take sannyas. And why he is afraid? He is afraid because he knows he has a very weak ego. If he surrenders, he is gone. He will not be able to stand. He is afraid of his inner weakness. He pretends on the outside, but he knows his inner reality. That he is ready. So he becomes defensive. He defends. Whenever a person of a strong ego comes, he says, okay, let us see. Let us try this too. He knows he is confident enough that even if he goes into some unknown path, he can still protect himself. And if he decides to come back, he can come back. He has enough trust, enough self-confidence. He has enough will. Remember, surrender is the last and the greatest act of will. Surrender is not a cheap and easy thing. It is not something that because you cannot stand, so you surrender. Because you were already falling, so you said, okay, I surrender. Because you were not able to stand on your feet. Surrender is not impotence. Surrender is not out of importance. It is out of tremendous power. You have lived the ways of the will and you have found nothing. You have looked in all the possibilities of the ego and you have only suffered. It simply hurts. Then you decide, now let us try the ultimate dropping of the ego. To drop the ego, you will need a great will. Otherwise, it is not easy to drop the ego. It is the greatest act in the world. The last. Only very courageous people can do it. In India, you will be surprised. All the great saviors, avatars are warriors. This is not coincidental. Krishna, Rama, both belong to the warrior race, Kshatriya. Buddha, Mahavir, 24 Tirthankaras of the Jainas, all are Kshatriyas. This has to be not only a coincidence. Why all these great people have come from the warriors? And they talk about surrender. And they say surrender is the way. They had the will to surrender. A Brahmin has not yet come to the state of a Buddha or a Mahavira. Why? The Brahmin has no will. He has thought from the very beginning, surrender. he has not arrived to a will that he can surrender. Or take it from a different angle. A poor man wants to renounce. What he will renounce? What he has got to renounce? What does it mean, his renunciation? Then a Rockefeller decides to renounce. His renunciation will mean something. It carries weight. He has to renounce something. A beggar declares, I have renounced the world. People will laugh. In the first place, you had nothing to renounce. A king renounces. Then the renunciation is meaningful. This man has known what wealth is. This man has known what power is. This man has known what will is. And knowing it well, he has understood that it cannot be the last thing in life. Good for the beginning. Good for the young people to play with a toy. But for those who are becoming mature, useless, they have to drop it. We give small children toys to play with. The day they become a little more mature, they throw the toys. And they start asking for the real thing. We give them a toy train and they say, forget about it. We give them a toy aeroplane and they say, throw it away. I want a real car, a real aeroplane. I want the real thing. Ego can give you only toys to play with. But it is needed. Otherwise you will never grow and never will become mature. One day you understand that now I need the real thing. And the real thing is God. And for God to happen, you have to surrender. Skinner is wrong because his philosophy is half. So is Annie Besant. She is wrong. Her philosophy is half. I am talking about a total philosophy. Up to the age 35, move in the ways of the world, the ways of will. Strengthen your ego as much as you can by knowledge, by power, by money, by ambition. Live it. Because that is the only way to know it. Go into the deepest hell the world can make you available. Know it. Because only by knowing one is liberated. And then suddenly a light will dawn on you. You will see the whole absurdity of it. And then you start returning home. Then you start returning towards the source. 35 years go into the world. And then the remaining part come back to yourself. First lose yourself so that you can gain. First sin so that you can become a saint. If you are from the very beginning a saint, your sainthood will not be of much value. I am not against sin. I am not against anything. I say use everything. Go into it. God has made this whole world available to you for a certain purpose. The purpose is learning. Sin is a lesson, is a must. If a child is a saint from the very childhood, is forced to be a saint, he will not have any spine. Let him first know what sin is. Let him himself become aware and let him drop it on his own accord. Don't force him, don't discipline him. Give him freedom to move. So one day he can see by his own eyes, feel by his own heart, and he can realize that Buddha is right, that Kabir is right, that Christ is right. But this has to come from your own understanding. Otherwise it is borrowed. And God never wants anybody second hand. Be first hand. Let your experience be original. So this is what I am to say to you. Will and surrender have to become part of your life together. Because you are man and woman together. And you are east and west together. The world is one, the earth is one village. All distinctions are just utilitarian, not real. What is east and what is west? And what is surrender and what is will? They both are part of the one wave. They are not two. They are a quanta. One. Two aspects of the one thing, one phenomenon. So grow into will and don't be afraid. Become a strong egoist, don't be afraid. Let it hurt. Let it become a self-torture. Let it become a cancer in your soul, then one day you drop it. And that dropping is out of your own feeling, own experience. Then it is beautiful. There is a danger, I must make you beware of it. The danger is that rather than coming to a synthesis, the danger is we may change roles. The East may become West and the West may become East. That is more possible. Seeing to the stupidity of human beings, that seems more possible. The East is trying to become West, more technological, more scientific, more materialistic, more communistic. In fact, the Pune people simply laugh at you that what you are doing here. What is there in the first place here? Meditating? What nonsense. They want to come to the West to know more engineering, to know more about electronics, to know more about computers, to know more about hydrogen and atom bombs, to know more how to create spaceships. How to create wealth, more wealth. They want to become more materialistic, more productive. And you are coming here, have you gone crazy? And when they come to the West, you cannot believe what they are doing here. You are fed up with your materialism. And what they are coming here for? To know better technology, to destroy their natural atmosphere, to pollute it, to destroy ecology. For what they are coming to the West? The West is getting fed up with the technology. The modern mind is trying to move away from technology. At least the new generation is absolutely against it. The new generation in the West can understand Buddha better than Einstein. The new generation can understand Mahavir, naked Mahavir better than Arnold, Darwin and Eddington and Rutherford. But in the Eastern universities, colleges, the new generation is hankering after Rutherford, Einstein, Max Planck. How to know more about science? The possibility is that the East may become West and the West may become East and the old foolishness continues. Again you are far apart. Again the meeting has not happened. The meeting has to happen. That is the only hope for humanity. And the meeting has to happen each individual. It cannot happen in books and philosophies. It has to happen in each individual. That is what Tantra is all about. Tantra is the oldest science to help you to come to an inner harmony, inner wedding, inner orgasm. your woman and man meet inside and give birth to the child Christ. Then you become a trinity, the father, the mother, the child. And when you are a trinity, you are blessed. You have come home. You know what life is. You have achieved the goal. The second question, I am a gambler in life. I brought suffering in to almost everybody who came close to me. My eyes have deceived everybody up to now, and when people out of their suffering caused by me sometimes said, "You are a good soul," then it was part of my game to deceive myself and feel good about their statement. And now in my first darshan, Bhagwan, you looked into my eyes and you said, "I am a very good person." But now as you, the master, are saying this, I can't deceive myself any longer and I can't accept these words from you. What are you doing? I am so puzzled, so lost. Have you also been deceived by me, or are you gambling with me? Please don't gamble. Please help me to drop the games. My whole being is hurt because Bhagwan, how could Bhagwan be deceived? I am not deceived. That's why I said it to you, that you are a good soul. I wanted it to settle from the very beginning. I wanted to bring it to the surface. That has been your problem. And I am here to bring your problem to the surface of your consciousness. I have not missed. You were caught. I am not deceived. I don't ordinarily say so. It is very rare I say to somebody that you are a good soul, because people are not. It is very rarely that I say so. But I had to say it to you, because this is your old game. And it is very good from the very beginning to be clear about it, that this game has not to be played here. Every individual has a particular weakness. And the weakness persists because you remain unaware of it. I wanted it to be perfectly clear to you. And it did the work. It was your first darshan with me. The question is from Vidya. It was your first darshan with me. And I wanted to start from the very beginning. I talked about your goodness because I wanted to create the problem so you can face it. And it is good that it created anxiety in you. It is good that it created a question in you. It is good that you became puzzled. It is good that you became confused. That is one of my ways to work on you, to confuse you. When you are clear, your ego is in control. Your clarity is nothing but your ego in control. When you are confused, your ego is thrown off center. Then you don't know what is what. The first thing is, when you come to me, that I should confuse you. I should throw you off balance, so your old ego control is no more in control. So you don't know what to do. When you don't know what to do, only then you ask me. And good that you have asked. And you say, "Please Don't gamble with me. I'm not gambling. Please help me to drop the games. That's why I have started this game of calling you a very great soul, good, a really good soul. It is to help you drop your egoistic attitudes. This is going to happen. You are going to become a good soul. You are not. That's true. But to realize this, that I am not a good soul, is the beginning. To realize that I don't know is the first step. To realize that I have yet to grow, I am yet far away, is the first step. If you continue to think that you are a good soul and you are not, then there is no hope for you. It is as if an ill person thinks he is healthy and well, and he never goes to the doctor. What is the point? He is healthy. He thinks he is healthy. And the disease goes on spreading. You have come to me, and I have diagnosed your disease absolutely. This has been your disease. You have been thinking you are good. You have been deceiving about your goodness. And when people trusted you and they were deceived, you were deceived by their deception. And this is how it went on feeding itself. It became a vicious circle. You are not good, but you can pretend to be good. And through pretension, you can deceive others. And when they are deceived, of course, you look your image in their eyes and you feel very happy. This is how things grow. When you feel very happy, you try to be more good. When you try to be more good, of course, the person thinks you are a really great soul, a Mahatma. Then in his eyes you can see your reflection more decorated, still more beautiful. You are again deceived. Now you have to try more because this person is there and this game continues. This is how it happens in everybody's life. You meet a woman or a man. You look at the woman. She looks at you. You look with adoration. She looks in your eyes, her adored image. She feels very good. She was hankering somebody to pay attention to you, and you are paying attention. She feels very good, that's why she looks with adoration at you. When she looks with adoration at you, of course you look into her eyes. You have never seen your image so beautiful. You feel tremendously good, enhanced. Your ego is strengthened. You try to be more loving. And this way the game continues. You fall in love. Your 99% love affairs are simply foolish. What you call romance is nothing but stupidity. And you feed each other. And you help each other. One day, you are going to be shocked. Then you want to remain close, more and close to each other. You want to be together 24 hours. Then you are ready to get married. Then you go for a honeymoon. And then you become acquainted with each other. And then the reality asserts. Reality cannot be denied for long. That's why your so-called great people, our so-called great saints, don't live in the marketplace. They go to the Himalayas. If they live in the marketplace, it is impossible. Sooner or later, the reality will assert. Reality cannot be defeated forever. You can create a fiction for few days, few moments, but you cannot live in the fiction forever. That is not possible. The fiction is bound to collide with reality and will collapse. If you really want to love a woman, never get married to her. If you really want to adore a man, escape as far away from him as possible. Then you will always love. But if you want to caress the whole love affair, get married, sooner the better. Go for a honeymoon. And by the time honeymoon is finished, everything is finished. Suddenly one day morning you look at the woman, she is an ordinary woman. You have heard the old story? A princess found a frog. And the frog said, "Lady, I have been cursed and for 5,000 years I have remained a frog. If you take me with you, and if you allow me to sleep with you in your bed, by the morning I will become a beautiful prince." You must have heard this type of stories are there. And the princess brings the frog, and in the morning he becomes a beautiful prince. But reality is just the opposite. You bring a beautiful prince, in the morning he becomes a frog. Every prince turns to be a frog in the end. And then you are puzzled, what happened? What went wrong? Nothing went wrong. The frog is a frog. The prince was your idea. It was your wish fulfillment. You were wanting to have a prince, so you had it. You were longing, you were projecting, you were dreaming. When you come to me, you are going to be shocked in many ways, and you are going to be confused in many ways. I have to dismantle your mind completely. It hurts. And it is not a very kind job. It is surgical. That's why I insist that first you become a sannyasin before I start the surgery. Because if you are not a sannyasin, there is every possibility you will escape in the middle of the surgery. And that will be more dangerous. Because then you will be mad. The work incomplete. Something dismantled and nothing created. That's why I insist first become a sannyasin. Because then I could trust that you will lie down at least. The time the operation takes, you will be on the operation table. You will not escape. You will trust me. Otherwise, I dismantle a part of you and you escape. Then you will be in a worse state than you were ever before. The work has to be completed. You will be thankful only when you have been completely renewed. You have been killed and you are reborn. Only then. Before that, there is going to be much pain. Growth goes through pain. Much suffering. Growth is not cheap. So in fact, I have started the work on you by calling you a good soul. I have thrown my net. You may think I have missed. I have not missed. Let me tell you one anecdote. The knife-throwing expert and his beautiful young assistant stood in front of their tent at the state fair while the spoiler described the wonderful act that would be performed within. Mistress Silas Hawkins was attracted by the knife-thrower, and Mr. Silas Hawkins detected in the assistant a few curves he had never seen before. They paid their two slim dimes, the tenth parts of a dollar, and entered the tent. Finally, the assistant stood against a wooden wall, doffed her spangled robe. Silas Hawkins gasped audibly. Then the knife thrower stepped upon the platform, and it was Mistress Hawkins' turn to gasp. The knife thrower pulled back his right arm and the steely blade went jinging through the air. It buried itself in the wall 1/8 of an inch from the assistant's cell pink ear. Silas Hawkins jumped to his feet with a cry. "Doggone," he said, "he missed her." I have not missed. It has exactly hit you where I wanted it to hit you. It has created all the turmoil in you. It has brought all the unconscious rubbish to the surface. The work has started. Now if you allow me, more socks will be coming. The more you allow, the more socks will be needed. It is arduous. To be reborn is going to be arduous. And this is the real birth. Even in physical birth, there is pain, and there is trauma, and there is suffering. This is a spiritual birth. One birth you have received from your parents, your father and mother. Another birth you receive from your master. You are born as a spiritual being. Much has to be cut. Much has to be dropped. Only the very essential has to be saved. The non-essential has to be completely destroyed. And the essential you don't know. You are identified with the non-essential. So I will have to cut your old identities by and by. By saying to you that you are a good soul, I have made you aware of a certain fact. This has been your game up to now. No more. I am not gambling with you. But things should be clear from the very beginning. You should be alert that what is going to happen. I am not here to console you. I am not here to give you any consolations whatever. I am here to destroy you utterly, because that is the only way to give you a new birth. Mullah Nasruddin was leaving his office at his usual quitting hour, 3:30, when he noticed a truck driver at the curb struggling unsuccessfully with a heavy case of books. "I will give you a hand," volunteered the mullah. The two seized opposite ends of the case and huffed and puffed several moments to no avail. "I am afraid it is hopeless," gasped Nasruddin. "We will never get it on the truck." "On?" screamed the driver. "I am trying to get it off. So let it be from the very beginning clear. You will try to save yourself and I am trying to destroy you. And I could see you directly, because the chief characteristic is such you cannot hide it. When disciples used to go to Gurudev, he will look into them. He will create situations to find out what is their chief characteristic. Unless the chief characteristic is known, work cannot start. Somebody is greedy. His problem is greed. And if you talk about anger, that is not his problem. If you talk about sex, that is not his problem. You will be surprised to know greedy people have no sexual problem. That's why Marwaris have to adopt children. Greedy people don't have sex energy. Their whole energy moves into greed. Money becomes their love object. They don't care a bit about women. So if you talk to a Marwari to take the vow of celibacy, he will be ready. It is not difficult. But don't tell him about renouncing his money or wealth. That is his problem. A politician does not bother much about women. His whole thrust, his sexual thrust is his politics. He wants to reach Delhi, Moscow, Washington. His whole energy is involved in that. His ambition is his sex. He wants to penetrate into the capital. Capital is his woman. His ambition is phallic. He can avoid women. He will not be much interested. Once he has reached Delhi, then he may start thinking about women, otherwise not. This has happened in India. Before the freedom, all the politicians were great Mahatmas, sages, servants of the people, celibates, great readiness to sacrifice. Then suddenly when they came into power, all that disappears. Now their energy was released. The energy was involved into reaching Delhi. They have reached Delhi, now what to do? The energy is there. Something has to be done with the energy. Then they got involved into thousand and one things. The chief characteristic has to be known. Somebody has anger as his chief characteristic. Somebody deception. Somebody ego. Somebody greed. Somebody jealousy. Somebody possessiveness. Different people. But if you come to a master, he can just look into you directly, and your chief characteristic is almost your soul. You don't know what else is your soul, but your chief characteristic is there, burning. Sherlock Holmes once confronted Dr. Watson with the statement, "Ah, my dear doctor, I see you have not donned your long winter underwear." Amazing. Watson is supposed to have replied, "How did you deduce that?" "Elementary," explained the peerless Holmes. "You have forgotten to put on your pants." "And as far as I am concerned, you are always without pants, remember. There is no way to deceive me. I am not deceived. Sometimes I may not be so rude. Sometimes I may be polite and may not say you what I am seeing in you. Sometimes I may feel it is not the right time. But whenever you come to me," and that is the meaning of darshan, "whenever you come and encounter me, you are absolutely naked to me. I may not say anything about it. I may wait for the right time. Or I may not say ever, and I may start working without saying it. That depends. But there is no possibility of deception. If you can deceive me, then I cannot be of any help to you. I can be helpful only because you cannot deceive me." The third question. "Organizations have always frightened me because I felt there is a built-in evilness and maybe a necessary evil. The Rajneesh Foundation is an organization and has every possibility of becoming a very powerful organization. Can you tell me why the foundation is necessary?" "Yes, because evil is necessary." The fourth question. "Why do we wear 108 beads on our malas? Does this belong to the world of ritualistic religion?" Yes, it belongs to ritualistic religion. Don't become ritualistic, but don't become anti-ritualistic either. A little ritual is beautiful. To become ritualistic is wrong, but a little ritual is just fine. A little ritual adds a spice to life. It gives salt to your food. It is tasteful. A life without any ritual will be a very poor, impoverished life. You meet somebody on the road and you say hello. It is a ritual. And he says, how are you? And you say, fine. It is a ritual. You are not fine, he knows, you know, everybody knows. Somebody you meet on the road, you smile. It is a ritual. You just watch. You will find life needs a little ritual. It makes life run smooth. It is lubricating. If the whole life becomes ritualistic, then it is dangerous. Then you are only eating salt. A little salt in the food is good, but to just feed on salt is dangerous. You will die. But to drop salt completely is also dangerous. And remember this always. I am never totally against anything, and I am never totally in favor of anything. I always keep balance. The orange robe, the mala, the locket, innocent ritual. But it adds spice. It gives you a feeling of community. And man needs few fictions to live. The truth is too hard. Yes, one day you will become able to live with the truth, but right now, no. You have to pass through many stages. Only in the ultimate jump you can drop all fictions. Then too you may not drop, because they are beautiful in themselves. They are not true, but they are beautiful in themselves. I am not against ritual. I am simply saying that ritual is not religion. Ritual is ritual. And a little ritual is always good. It keeps you in balance. It keeps you sane. Otherwise, people start moving into extremes. There are few people whose whole religion is ritualistic. There is no reality at all. Then there is Krishnamurti. His whole idea is non-ritualistic. There is no poetry, no fiction, no myth, no prayer, no meditation, nothing. Just a bare, naked statement of truth. I don't believe in extremes. I would like you to remember the tightrope walker. Always keep it in mind. The tightrope walker. He is a symbol of life. He leans to the left, feels that now if he leans a little more, he will fall. Immediately he balances by leaning towards the right. Then he starts falling towards the right. Immediately he balances himself again, leaning towards the left. He continuously leans from left to right, right to left. And that's how he keeps himself in the middle. This is the mystery.
To keep in the middle, he has to lean to the left. He has to lean to the right. To keep in the middle, he has to be very illogical. Because the middle is not static, it is dynamic. Life is not static. So always, if you want to keep yourself balanced, healthy, sane, you will have to lean both the sides. Sometimes a little ritual, sometimes no ritual. Sometimes a little scripture, sometimes no scripture. Sometimes a little worship, sometimes no worship. Sometimes a little prayer, sometimes no prayer. This way, you will become a tightrope walker. And remember, again I repeat, the middle is not a static posture. You cannot just stand there. You cannot say to the tightrope walker, why you go on leaning this way and that? Why all this effort? Just stand there in the middle. Then he will fall. If you are static, you will die. Life is process, dynamic, river-like. Go and watch a river. Sometimes it flows to the north, sometimes to the east, sometimes to the south, and goes on leaning both the sides, and one day reaches to the ocean. Everything is accepted in proportion. The sixth question. I hear there is a room in the ashram called the office of the grand seducer of the oldies. How old is an oldie? The question is from Astha. No, it is a very technical thing. But I will try to give you a layman's conception. And I will give you the right address where you can find more informed and expert opinion. Yes, there is a secret organization here in the ashram called SIN. S-I-N. S stands for seduction. Seduction into neo-sannyas. That is the name of the organization, SIN. And there are three branches of the organization. For the babies and for the oldies and those who are in between. For the babies up to the 14th year. Because by that time, sexual maturity happens. And the baby is no more a baby. In fact, he is ready to create new babies. So he cannot be a baby. So you can demark the line 14 years is the line for the babies. After birth, 14 years. Before death, 14 years is the limit of the oldies. If 70 is the average life span, then 56 is the demarcation for the oldies. And in between are everybody else. So three departments exist, three branches of SIN. For the babies, Siddhartha and Purva take care. For the in between, Tirtha and Manisa. For the oldies, Paritosh and Parijat. But this distinction of the oldies in between and the babies is applicable only here. In America, there are only two, the babies and the oldies. The in between exists not. That is a strange thing that has happened in America. People try to remain babies as far long as they can. They go on pushing the line. 50, and still they are babies. 55, and still they are babies. and 56, and still they are babies. And it is 31st December, 56, and they are still babies. When they cannot push any longer, when it is impossible, they simply become oldies. From babies to oldies, direct. I have heard about a salesman who was succeeding, a door-to-door salesman. And all his colleagues were surprised because they were selling the same goods but not so successfully. He was earning almost 10 times, so they gave him a party and asked him, please tell about your secret. He said, there is nothing much, it is simple. Even if an old hag, a 60-year-old woman, rotten, opens the door, I say, baby, is your mother at home? And that works. And I am immediately welcomed. America has gone crazy. All natural limits have disappeared. From infancy, people simply move into senility. That's why the great problem of the gap of generations has arisen. Because there is no in between to link. The bridge is broken. Americans are crazy. Just as the old Italian said, but I should not anticipate. First, I must tell you the anecdote. Wallace Rayburn, author of Some of It Was Fun, entered Naples, Italy, with the victorious troops who threw the Nazis near the end of World War II. A grateful native offered to introduce him to a sister at home. Is she beautiful? Asked Rayburn. Ah, bella, bella. Enthused the native. Young? Si. And is she pure? Persisted Rayburn. The native turned from him in disgust, remarking, these Americans and Canadians are all crazy. Natural limits are forgotten. Natural things are forgotten. In America, this distinction may not be applicable, but here, and except America, everywhere in the world, these are the three demarcations. The babies, who are not yet interested in sex, and the oldies, who have grown out of it, and the people in between, who go on wavering, who are still on the tight rope. And of course, babies can convert babies. So Siddhartha, little Siddhartha and Purva. Little Siddhartha right now is traveling in America, trying to convert babies there, because that is the country where greatest number of babies exist. And for the in-between, Tirtha and Manisa are in charge of the sin. And for old people, Parijat and Paritos. So Astha, if you really want a very informed expert opinion, you go to Paritos. He is in charge. And right now, he is very much busy because many parents have come for Christmas. And he is seducing them into neo-sannyas. And somebody to help people has put a notice on his door. That's how this question has arisen. Somebody has put a notice on Paritos' door, office of the grand seducer of the oldies. Just to help people, so those who want to find out the office, they can find it easily. The seventh question, what is your attitude to money? I have lived without money, I have lived with money, and one confession I have to make, it is always good to live with money than without. Money is useful. One should not be used by it, that's all. I'm not against money. It should be used. It is a good utilitarian invention. It helps. It is tremendously useful. But use it, don't be used by it. Money should not be your master. You should be the master, that's all. And if you choose, then my suggestion is always choose with money. It is better to be with money than without money. I'm not saying you will be more happy. I'm saying only you will have more choice to choose your misery according to your heart. A poor man has not much choice. He has to be miserable, whatsoever misery happens to be. A rich man has much more choice. The poor man has to suffer in a limited way. The rich man suffers unlimitedly. He can suffer here, he can suffer in New York, he can suffer in London, he can suffer in Peking, he has the whole world to suffer. And sooner or later he will be suffering on Moon and Mars. He has more freedom. And freedom is good. If you are poor, you have to suffer one woman. If you are rich, you have to suffer many women. It opens doors. So if you ask me, I will suggest if you are trying to choose to live with money or without, I will say live with money. It will give you more experience. It will bring you to God sooner. Because you will be tired soon. A poor man is never tired of money, remember. Because he has no money, how to be tired with something you don't have? A poor man always hankers and desires and dreams about money. Only a rich man is finished with money. In fact, that is the definition of a rich man, one who is finished with money. He is the rich man. He has known. He has seen what money can give. And now he would like to have something more that money can never give. I am not saying money can give you God, our peace, our happiness. But there are foolish people. One Mahatma came to see me a few years before. And he said, I have renounced money because through money you cannot have bliss. But I said, who told you in the first place that you will have? Through money you can have a beautiful house. Who told you that you will have bliss? Who has told you that you will have happiness? You will have a big car. There are foolish people who expect through money that bliss is going to happen. Then they become a disillusioned one day. Money is not wrong. Their illusion. Their projection was wrong. Money is not at fault. If you go and try to get out, squeeze oil through sand, and oil does not come out of it, will you say, the sand is at fault? You were foolish, you were stupid. In the first place, who had told you that by squeezing sand you will get oil? Money cannot give you bliss, cannot give you peace, cannot give you God, cannot give you paradise. But to come to know this, one has to have money. Then you become clearly aware that what money can give and what money cannot give. When a person has known what money can give, his efforts start moving beyond the money, beyond the world. Money is a beautiful invention. One of the most important inventions man has ever made. Next only to language, First is language, second is money. These are the two most important foundations for civilization, society, culture. I am not against. I am simply saying what money can give and what money cannot give. If you are thinking that by holding money, one day suddenly you will become meditative, then you are a fool. Not by holding money you are going to become meditative. And remember, not by renouncing money you are going to become meditative. These both are foolish people. First they think by money they will get God, then one day they think by renouncing money they will get God. But in both the cases they remain money oriented. God has nothing to do with money. You can have God with as much money as you want, and you can have God without money, as much without money as you want. God has nothing to do with money. A rich man can become meditative, a poor man can become meditative. But my understanding is this, that if a poor man wants to become meditative, he will need tremendous intelligence. Because he will have to see the futility of money, which he has not. He will need tremendous intelligence. Kabir must have been tremendously intelligent. I think more intelligent than Buddha and Mahavir. My reason for saying so is this, that Buddha had money, Mahavir had money. If they became fed up, it is simple. It is logical. It is as simple as 2 plus 2 are 4. If Buddha had not renounced the palace, then it would have proved only thing that he was stupid. If he renounced, that does not prove that he was very greatly intelligent. That simply proves an average intelligence. But Kabir, Christ, Muhammad, they are more intelligent people. They don't have money. They don't have anything. And still they became aware that money is useless. They don't have a great kingdom. And without having it, they renounced it. They must be very sharp people, tremendously alert. They could see through things that they don't have. Their transparency, their clarity is tremendous, incredible. If a poor man wants to be religious, he will need great intelligence. If a rich man wants to be religious, he needs only average intelligence. So if a poor man becomes religious, he is a great sage. And if a rich man does not become religious, he is a fool, stupid. The last question. Each day when I leave Chuangtazu auditorium, I see 3 white robes hanging in the laundry room. Yet I never see you wearing more than 1 robe. I have a suspicion that you are actually one of triplets. This would explain how you go on contradicting yourself in successive lectures and appear in more than 1 place at the same time. So you have found it out. Now keep it a secret. And don't tell it to anybody. That is true. I have to confess. When you have found, I have to confess. That is true. I am a Trinity. The Trinity I was talking about. Father, Mother, the Son. And yes, it is true. That's why it is so easy for me to contradict myself. Sometimes the Father is speaking. Sometimes the Mother, and sometimes the Son. You will find 3 rivers meeting in me. It is a Sangam. It is a meeting point of 3 rivers. A Triveni, a Trinity, a Trimurti. 3 faces I have. That's why it is so easy for me to move through all the traditions. Because there are only 3 traditions in the world. Three is a very basic unit. The father, the mother and the son. That's why it will be difficult for you to make a coherent philosophy out of my assertions. You will have to have great intelligence to see the coherence. Otherwise the contradiction is very obvious. When I speak as a father, I speak as a father authoritative. When I speak as the mother, I speak as a mother non-authoritative, loving. When I am a father, I order you, command you. Then I am a Moses, Ten Commandments. When I am a mother, I persuade you. I don't order you. Then I am not a Moses. Then I am more like a Krishna. He persuades Arjuna. He persuades in 1001 ways. Very friendly, very lovingly. By and by, he brings him in. And when I am the son, I speak rebellion, revolution. Then I speak as Christ, as Buddha. And I am all three, and I would like you also to be all three. To be one is not to be very rich. To be all three together is to be very rich. And the very last question. What is this astonishing nonsense about you having no charisma? True. It is astonishing and it is nonsense. How it can be I having no charisma? But now things can be easy. Now you have understood the principle of Trinity. And I told you there are three types of masters. The charismatic, the methodical, and the natural. The father is the charismatic. The mother is the methodical. The son is the natural. The word natural comes from a root which means out of birth. Certainly so. You are right. It is amazing and it is nonsense. One of my part is charismatic. One of my part is methodical. One of my part is natural. And that's how it should be. A perfect master should be all three simultaneously. So please, if I say something, now you can sort it out. You can have three das. The father, the mother, the son. And you can go on collecting and everything will be sorted out, figured out, easily, simply. And don't ask me that why you said that one day, because you are not asking to the same person. And it is not so easy for me as it is in this anecdote. Let me tell you. In Nathan Ansubel's treasury of Jewish folklore appears the story of a famous preacher of Dubno whose driver stopped en route to a lecture date and said, "Rabbi, do me a favor. For once I would like to be the one receiving all the honors and attention to see what it feels like. For this one engagement, exchange clothes with me. You be the driver and let me be the rabbi." The preacher, a merry and generous soul, laughed and said, "All right, but remember, Clothes don't make the rubber. If you are asked to explain some difficult passage of the law, see that you don't make a fool of yourself. The exchange was effected. Arrived at their destination, the bogus rabbi was received with tumultuous enthusiasm and obviously loved every minute of it. Finally, however, there came the dreaded moment when an extremely tricky question was put to him. He met the test nobly. "A fine lot of scholars you are," he thundered. "Is this the most difficult problem you could ask me? Why? This is so simple, even my drivel could explain it to you." Then he called the preacher of Dubno. "Driver, come here for a moment and clarify the law of these dull-witted fellows. This is not so easy for me. Because when I am here, the other two are not. I cannot call. Come and explain this for me." So please never raise any questions about contradictions. Whatsoever I have said someday, it is finished. I am finished with it. I don't look backwards. I go ahead. And there is no need to worry about it. Whatsoever I am saying right now is the truth. The present is the truth. The past is dead. All those assertions of the past are dead. Next moment, again, the truth will have its own form. Then don't carry this moment with you. This is my whole teaching, not to carry the past and just remain true to the moment. Then there will be no contradiction. There is none. The contradictions appear only because you are trained too much logically. And I am an illogic person. My whole logic is that of illogic. I am an irrationalist. Yes, I am three. But please don't tell it to anybody. Enough for today.